Coming up on Behind the Headlines, two senators say the consultant hired to defend Amendment 3 in court is acting unethically. So what's the reaction to calls for Jean Scher to step aside? House Speaker Becky Lockhart throws her support behind the proposal to build a new mega hotel attached to the Salt Palace. But will her fellow lawmakers agree? The committee evaluating the relocation of the Utah State Prison recommends, once again, moving out of Draper. Who would benefit from such a move? And a man who called 911 three times gets the runaround, and the delay costs him his life. Will the episode finally force cities in Salt Lake County to streamline the fractured emergency communication system? The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, a recommendation on the prison, new high-level support for a mega hotel, a communication breakdown with 911, and more. And later on in the program, Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. But first, joining me to talk about the top news stories of the week, Tribune Justice reporter Brooke Adams. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Salt Lake County government reporter Mike Gorrell. Mike, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And columnist Paul Raleigh. Paul, great to have you.
Good morning.
And you can join us. What do you think about moving the prison out of Draper? Do you think Speaker Lockhart's support on the convention center hotel idea will rally the troops? And how do you think 911 should be fixed? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. You can put your comments on our website at sltrib.com, or you can call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. That's 801-355-8255. Brooke, I want to start with you. A committee is recommending moving the state prison out of Draper. And this is a conversation that's been going on for a couple of years. Why? Why do supporters say the prison needs to relocate?
Okay, well, PRADA version 2.0, as I like to refer to them, recommended this week that they move the prison. And the major considerations for them were the age and deterioration of the Draper facility, looking at a 20-year projection of growth in the prison population. They also factored in access to health care and hospitals and courts and a need for new programming options at the prison. And so they said when they looked at the land value, the cost of building a new facility, it all equaled moving the prison, that was a good idea. So they have recommended to the legislature that the prison be moved. They've given the legislature four options for how to do that. And the difference in those options is basically how it's phased in, how quickly that might happen. Hmm. And one more thing I'll mention is a key part of moving the prison, they say there has to be an expansion of the Gunnison facility. It needs to eventually increase by 960 beds. I think in the governor's budget, he's recommended spending $36 million to add 180 beds immediately.
So we're talking about the main prison in Draper, and then there's this satellite prison in Gunnison,
right.
And the prison population keeps growing,
yes.
So we got to do something.
Yeah, they're estimating that in 20 years, right now we have about 7,000 inmates, we'll have 10,000 or so by then.
Who's on the committee?
On the product committee?
Yeah.
Well, boy, let's see if I can run them off the top of my head.
Or maybe just general
So the chairman
groups.
Is Lane Summer-Hayes, who was asked by the governor to lead the board. You have Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. You have the new Draper Mayor Troy Walker. You have Representative Brad Wilson and Representative Eric Hutchings. You have Ron Gordon from the CCJJ, the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, I believe that's the acronym there. And let's see, David Luna, who I think has a really good background in real estate type issues. Boy, I'm probably forgetting somebody, but...
So a lot of public officials, a lot of people
Judith
who...
Judith Atherton,
former judge.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you mentioned Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams, and he is not sold on the relocation
right.
idea quite yet. What are his concerns?
He was the lone no vote in the recommendation to the legislature this week, and he had two issues. He said he wanted sort of more answers and a surety about the involvement of the city, Draper City, and the county in how the land that the prison currently occupies, the nearly 700 acres, is redeveloped. And he hadn't heard that yet, I guess, or didn't feel comfortable with that. The second issue for him was he wants much more upfront discussion and direction on how we're going to deal with an increasing prison population. He wants us to look at reform and recidivism and how to curb that growth.
Is the prison reform concept or package of concepts, I mean, is it even part of the discussion at this point?
It actually is. They say that's one of the major considerations. They listed four major considerations in listing in moving the prison, and one of those, I think two of them, deal with improving the prison system to reduce recidivism and, you know, looking ahead at anticipated reforms in the criminal justice system. Mm. There's a lot of talk nationally about sentencing reform, and that's beginning to take place here in Utah as well.
So you said that the number is expected to grow. How many inmates are currently at the Draper location?
We have, at Draper itself, I think there's 4,000. And then there's about, I believe, the total number is 7,000. I think there's about 1,600 at Gunnison. And then the rest are spread through the county jails around the state.
And the projections are how big?
Up to 10,000.
Up to 10,000.
Yeah.
So a new site has not been named,
right,
even though the recommendation is to move. They don't know where yet?
Right. I asked Mr. Summerhays that question at the end of the meeting. You know, who can you say who has put in or given you a pitch so far to be the new home of a prison? And early on, Tooele County had said they were interested. I think their commission passed a resolution expressing interest. But what he also mentioned to me is that there are some properties in Salt Lake County. We don't know where those are yet. And, you know, I guess we'll hear. You can picture where there might be some big plots of land within the county, but don't know yet.
Not that many.
Yeah,
I'm thinking
many.
The tailings pond. I don't know. Paul Raleigh, what do you think about the proposal to move? It looks like it's gaining some momentum here. Mayor McAdams still has some concerns, but others seem to be ready to do it. What do you think?
Well, first of all, as a political cynic, I'd be interested in knowing who owns the land in Salt Lake County that they're looking at possibly moving the prison to.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would be a little cynical about that. The last time the prison was moved, it was in the early 1950s, and it was
Where was it before?
It was where Sugar House Park and Highland High School are now.
Of course.
And so when they moved it in the early 50s, rather than turn it over to developers, they turned it into a park.
That's not going to happen this time, Paul.
No, of course not. And, of course, the argument is that the developers, that'll offset the cost and everything else. But I'm not so sure that there's been enough discussion about how much pollution, you know, this will add into the Salt Lake Valley, which you've got the legislature at least giving lip service to it right now, about how they're going to improve the air quality. And then at the same time, they're talking about, you know, putting in whole, you know, whether it's residential or business or whatever they do, all this another big development. The other question that, you know, that people were talking about early on that seems to have gone away is, you know, the zoo is kind of in a cramped area, and there's been talk from time to time about moving that somewhere to, you know, for give more space to the zoo. And at some point there was discussion about if they do move the prison, maybe putting a zoo there, but of course that doesn't seem to be discussed much anymore.
Hasn't come up, has it, Brooke?
I haven't heard that, but that's an interesting idea. It'd be more centrally located for people than it is right now at the mouth of Immigration Canyon, right?
Yeah.
One thing I might mention, if I could, is they've valued the property at the prison at $130 million, and the conversation during the meeting this week was that may be a lowball figure, that some of the people thought that was very conservative, might be worth more. And the comment was made that, you know, if it is more, this could actually save the state money to move the prison. So I don't know. I need to spend a lot more time looking at the numbers. One thing I might mention, they said the cost of relocating the prison was building a new facility would be $471 million. And in 2005, when Wickstrom and Associates looked at that, and they were looking at building a 6,000-bed facility, they valued the cost of that, of building a new facility, at $461
million.
Hmm. So I don't know. Those numbers need a little...
How big is the campus? How much acreage are we talking about?
Right now, the prison occupies nearly 700 acres. So, you know, some of the...
I'll have to do the math on that one, but it does seem a little low.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a 200-page report, their preliminary report. I haven't had a chance to make my way through the whole thing, and I've just taken some of the highlights. One other interesting thing I'll mention quickly is I did notice that they said there needs to be a new facility for female inmates. That population is consistently hitting the maximum capacity load in the Timpanogos facility that they now occupy. And the second thing with the female population is I don't think Utah is doing nearly enough or what other states are doing for female inmates. For example, most of those women have children, and we're not doing a lot right now to help them become better parents when they leave prison.
Mm.
So I think that might be some of the reform that people might be looking at.
And the plans for a new facility, I would hope that they are incorporating those women inmate needs as far as
child care. This recommendation, this preliminary report from MGT of America, that's the consultant that Prada 2.0 hired, I did notice they make a reference that we need to do something and address the female inmate population.
So who makes the final decision? Is it the legislature?
Okay. It's up to them. Everybody watch the legislature at this point. All eyes there. I'm not quite sure how this happens. I think they need to pass a bill to reauthorize Prada, and that was one of the recommendations this week, that Prada be given the authority to send out RFPs to hire a design build contractor to begin the first phase potentially of construction, and to begin an RFP for a programmer, somebody who's going to look at how we program and, you know, how that will affect the building that's built. So there, I think, has to be a bill to do that. Some of the other aspects of this recommendation, I think, are just a money need for money, and so that may just happen in appropriations. So, but the legislature has to decide which of the four options they're going to pursue, which one they like, and that, as I mentioned earlier, is a matter of phasing, how quickly it happens. So we'll see.
Paul Rowley, is it happening this session?
I would predict no.
Why?
It's always easier to kick things down the can when they get controversial, especially when you have a speaker who wants to run for governor. So I think that they'll make some progress. My guess is that they're going to put it back on a study committee and study it again over the year, you know, and continue to get recommendations from Prada. And
I'm going to take your bet on, and I'm going to say, yeah, I think something will happen this year.
Why do you think that?
Well, they're hitting maximum capacity, and they need beds now. So I think Gunnison will happen. And I asked Representative Wilson that very question, and Representative Hutchings, do you think you've got the will and the backing of your colleagues in the legislature? And they seem to think, you know, that they could muscle this through. So
okay, we got what, 35 days or 33 days and
so
counting?
So Paul, you and I can talk again at the end.
Sure.
Absolutely. You
know, we can bet a cupcake.
Okay.
A cupcake. I like it. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams, also Mike Gorell is with us, as well as columnist Paul Rowley. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Mike Gorrell and Brooke Adams, also with us columnist Paul Raleigh. And if you've got something to say about the prison move or 911 or the legislative session or anything else on your mind, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can put your comments online at sltrib.com. I want to move on to another sort of real estate issue, the mega hotel, the so-called mega hotel. Backers of a convention center hotel attached to the Salt Palace gained a very powerful ally this week. Mike Gorrell, what happened?
Yeah, they sure did. On Wednesday morning, Mayor McAdams brought out the newest supporter of the bill, which is House Speaker Becky Lockhart. And her support is particularly important because she voted against the bill last year when it went down to defeat 39-35 in the House. So assuming that the House Speaker has long coattails and that she can bring a number of people with her, that would seem like it would be a big boost for the Convention Center Hotel's prospects.
Okay, so she voted against it last year. The tides have changed. What happened? What persuaded her that this was a good idea?
Well, the main thing that McAdams was able to do is he came up with a plan to help the rural parts of the state out so that it would show that if the legislature supports the Convention Center Hotel, it doesn't just help Salt Lake County, that it'll end up helping the whole state. And what McAdams came up with in consultation with Representative Wilson from Kaysville and Senator Stuart Adams, who are going to be sponsoring the bill that I haven't seen it actually yet. It's supposed to come out today. But essentially what they are going to do is take about 5% of the new sales taxes that are generated by that hotel property and use that money to create advertising that Visit Salt Lake and other tourism promoters can distribute to the people who are coming to conventions here in advance so that they can possibly add a day or a week onto their trip, and they'd find out all about the five national parks and other things like Hardware Ranch or other things, St. George, all the things that various parts of the state have to offer.
So they were able to demonstrate it's not a Salt Lake County thing, it's a state thing.
Right, that it's one of those things where people come into Salt Lake, but the benefits flow statewide.
So did the funding mechanisms change at all?
Essentially, no.
Okay.
No, what it would be would both, it's a post-performance tax rebate to the developer who comes in. It's the same system that the Governor's Office of Economic Development uses when it tries to entice all kinds of different businesses to locate or expand in Utah. And that's one of the things that earned this plan the support of like the Salt Lake Chamber and other business groups. And so but this bill also puts a cap. Earlier it had been talking about like $33 million apiece from Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, and the state. All of which get sales tax from this property, that they would set aside some of that. But the new cap limits that to $25 million. That's about the only difference from last year's bill.
Okay. But the state would still lend its support.
Yes.
Got it. Convention and Visitors Bureau folks like it. Business leaders like it. This tweet from Downtown Plan SLC, lots of support from SLC community for Convention Center Hotel and the Salt Palace through Downtown Plan SLC process. So some fans out there listening, who doesn't like it?
Well, the existing hotels, mainly the Grand America and the Little America, which are high-end convention hotels in their own right, and the Utah Taxpayers Association, they just don't think that the state should be putting public money into a private venture.
Mm-hmm. And they issued a study, I think, through the Hotel Association.
Right, and with the Taxpayers Association, that basically their conclusion was that there would be a $105 million transfer of wealth in the first 5 years that the convention center is open, in which that amount of money flows out of the existing hotels and into the new hotel.
I see. So just a transfer of money.
Right. But Mayor McAdams says that he doesn't think that that's going to be the case, and that he says that the new business that will be generated by the Convention Center Hotel and all the bigger conventions that it will help us to get we'll bring in enough new customers that just won't be going to that new hotel. It's a kind of a rising tide lifts all ships type of thing, so that the money that those existing hotels would lose will be made up for by new business that comes into the city. That's at least the mayor's argument.
Okay. Brooke?
Mike, can you remind us how big the hotel would be and where they're planning to put it?
Well, the numbers of rooms is a little bit nebulous. It ranges from anywhere from 800 to 1,250. It would have to be adjacent to the Salt Palace, and because it's a convention center hotel, and they want to have, would like to have some kind of a like bridge over Main Street type of a connection, so that the people who have their headquarters at this hotel can go over to the convention at the Salt Palace without having to go outside, and it would just be an easy transition. Now, there's several properties around the Salt Palace right now that you might be able to envision as the site, but nobody really knows. And if indeed the legislature comes through and passes this bill and it moves forward as to having a funding mechanism available, it'll be interesting to see the scrambling among the property owners in town to try to get to be the preferred site.
Okay. Paul Raleigh, legislature. Becky Lockhart likes it now. What does that mean?
I can see this having a possibility of passing. I mean, Mike alluded to this, but the proponents of this, right now there's a site right across the street from Energy Solutions Arena, where a construction site where a hotel is coming up, and the proponents say that having this big convention center will attract these larger conventions, and it will help. It'll fill other hotels as well. Obviously, the people building the hotel next to the Energy Solutions Arena are optimistic about it. And with the speaker being behind it, I think that has a good chance of passing this year.
It's kind of an interesting choice for her, though. I mean, if, as you say, she is running for governor, is this an election issue?
I don't know. I shouldn't be too cynical and say everything that Becky Lockhart does, is motivated by her running for governor. But I think it was a very important aspect that Ben McAdams, agreed to, that Mike talked about, where they will promote other areas of the state. The speaker has, for the last year, ever since the last session got out, has been holding town hall meetings all over the state with Republican legislators from whatever area she was in. And I think she's had a couple of dozen. And so she's trying to get her name out throughout the state, showing herself as a proponent for economic development throughout the state. So this gives her a chance to say that she was able to negotiate a bargain with, in which the rest of the state will benefit on all these rural areas that she's been going all around. Because those rural areas have a lot more clout selecting a nominee, a party nominee, than their populations might indicate, simply because of our caucus convention system and that sort of thing. So the more she reaches out to those rural areas, I think she's increasing her popularity going into a party convention.
Hmm. This is from Skier Jim 7 on our website, sltrib.com. How come our ultra-conservative Republican lawmakers won't spend taxpayer dollars on education, but have no problem using those tax dollars to build a hotel or move a prison that doesn't need moving? That sounds like a question made for you, Paul.
Well, the argument is that this is an economic development issue, and you spend money to make money. And so if they start bringing in these really large conventions, their argument is that this will bring in more money that they can eventually use for education. Of course, you use income taxes for education, but this would bring more money eventually and through all the other taxes into the state coffers.
How much more money, Mike? What's the projection? What would it bring in economic development?
I haven't seen a particular figure on that, but it's a lot. There's no question, I think, that conventioneers are good business for the state because it's one of those cases where you have outside money coming in and it stays here. And so it's always a big benefit in that way.
Okay, so what bills are you watching at the legislature to make this happen? Is there something that we should be watching as spectators?
Well, there's a bill that's supposed to be coming out today, sponsored by Representative Brad Wilson, that promotes this financial mechanism for the convention center. And Stuart Adams is carrying the bill over in the Senate, so he's also a Republican. So one of the things McAdams wanted was to have it be a bipartisan issue.
Mm-hmm. All right, you're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Also with me, Tribune reporters Mike Gorell, Brooke Adams, and columnist Paul Raleigh. And you are welcome to join us if you've got questions or comments about the news of the week. Send your tweets to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Paul, I want to move on to a column that you wrote earlier this week that was totally tragic. It broke my heart. You wrote about a man from Draper who dialed 911 and got the runaround. What happened?
Well, what happened was Sandy recently moved from the VEC, the Valley Emergency Communications Center, that is the 911 dispatch center, mm-hmm. For unincorporated Salt Lake County and most of the cities in Salt Lake County, and they joined up with Salt Lake City and their dispatch center, because you've got these two different dispatch centers. Salt Lake City wanted its own, and Sandy decided to move in with them. They thought they would save money. So when a call goes to the Sandy Dispatch Center, now it goes into Salt Lake City's Sandy area. It goes into Salt Lake City's Dispatch Center. When you call from cell phones, of course, the nearest tower will pick up your cell phone and then direct it to where that belongs. So this gentleman lived in Draper, and the cities that ring around Sandy, cell phones from those cities will hit the Sandy towers, and then on a 911 call be directed to Salt Lake City. So he called, and he felt like he was having a heart attack, and he got Salt Lake City because his cell phone hit the Sandy tower, which directed into the Salt Lake City dispatch. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you're in Draper, and so they said they needed to transfer the call. Now, there are different versions of this story depending on who you talk to. There's some finger-pointing going on between the jurisdictions. Mm. But the call was dropped. He called back, got a different dispatcher in Salt Lake City again. Transfer was made. At some point, they actually canceled the call because he called back. He said he was feeling better. Salt Lake City said that they relayed that information to VEC, that he was feeling better. And the VEC people say that what Salt Lake City told him was that he told him to cancel a call. Now, the Salt Lake City people told me that they would never cancel a call, but they just relayed that to VEC. And so at some point, no emergency vehicle came. And in the meantime, he called his wife, who was at work, and told her he was having a heart attack, and because his call got dropped twice, and he couldn't seem to be getting through. And so she came home, and by the time she got home, he was dead from his heart attack. And then she called, and then after she got there, the emergency people came. And so the issue is if we should figure out a way to have a better communication system where you've got these two different dispatch centers and how the calls are going to be, transferred into there. There was an incident last fall where a guy from Sandy, his wife was having a medical problem, and he called, and he got Salt Lake City, who then told him no, he needed to get Sandy. And then he sat there on the phone while the two dispatchers argued with each other over which one had the jurisdiction, which one needed to roll on this. And so finally, so never mind, I'll just run and get my neighbor.
Right, and, right. I mean, it just makes you shake your head. Mike Gorell, how is the system supposed to work? Obviously not this way.
Well, no, it's not. In fact, the Salt Lake County has been working since last summer to try to change it. The council appropriated, at McAdams' request, $1.4 million to try to get the systems onto the same operating platform. Because, like the mayor had said, we don't want to be doing this kind of jockeying for who's in charge here and let somebody die on the other end of the line. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what happened. And so the county appropriated money to help offset the costs that whatever system they abandoned, all the money that the member cities or had put into that system, they could get some kind of a reimbursement or offset for what they had expended. But in December, there was a meeting between the two different sides, and they went back and forth for hours, and nobody wants to give up their ground.
I mean, is it going to take something like this tragedy to get them to move?
You know, tragedies often are the impetus to get things done. And after this, a couple of days later, earlier this week, Brad D. From Weber County, who's a human resources director up there and a legislator, introduced a bill that would force this to take place.
Interesting. Paul, you had quite a response to your column.
Yeah.
Ed, I mean, response, did you hear other stories that were similar? Or?
Yes. Nothing as terrible as this where somebody died.
Sure.
I've heard a lot of stories of people calling in and getting dropped or, you know, getting transferred, and then the call got dropped. The other issue is, you've got all these different cities with their own fire departments and that sort of thing, too. And even though they all belong to VEC, you know, they have a boundary. They set up the boundaries, and some boundaries go across city lines and that sort of thing. And the way I've been told that there's some politics that goes on there, because whatever emergency vehicle or fire truck is rolls, I mean, they get money from the insurance. You know, they're the ones who charge and get money from the insurance companies or whatever to get reimbursed. And so I'm told that there are several areas within the county where if you're in a certain area and you call in, you don't get the closest fire truck to your emergency. Oftentimes, to roll, it'll be one quite a ways away. Another, I talked to the Cottonwood Heights police chief, and he told me that there was a school bus driver in Cottonwood Heights who, this was last fall sometime, who had a fire on his in his bus, and so he called 911 from his cell phone. And he ended up getting the fire station over by the baseball park on Main Street and 13th South in Salt Lake City.
That's helpful.
Yeah. So, obviously there, with these different systems and that sort of thing, there needs to be, like Mayor McAdams says, he wants one, platform, software platform that can handle, where everybody's on the same page together.
Mm. So it's a money issue. It's a turf issue. The legislature wants to make this happen. I mean, but from the consumer point of view, it doesn't inspire a lot of confidence in me calling 911 when I need it. You know?
Right, yeah.
That's a little scary. Okay, well, let's move on to another topic. Speaking of the law, the outside legal counsel for that the state hired to defend Amendment 3 before the Tenth Circuit has his critics. And I guess this week he gave some lawmakers a little bit of legal advice, and a couple of senators are not real thrilled about it. What did Gene Scher have to say?
Well, I don't know what his response actually is, but what happened is Jim DeBacchus, who is in the legislature, was critical of Gene Scher, the outside counsel hired by the state to craft and defend its Amendment 3 appeal at the Tenth Circuit Court. And Gene Scher has also apparently going to be doing some work after he completes this appeal for the state for the Sutherland Institute. And Mr. DeBacchus believes
which is a conservative think tank.
Right, a conservative think tank here in town. And what they want him to do is to craft some legal papers that can be used by states and governments and attorneys around the country in defending these traditional marriage statutes. So Mr. DeBacchus thinks that's a conflict of interest. The discussion that went on this week is that he should not be getting any money from this outside counsel. And I think it's mostly focused on, you know, it's understandable, I guess, that Gene Scherer's beliefs and personal views are in line with the state's on his defense of Amendment 3. What's less clear is should he be giving any commentary on the non-discrimination bill that's before the legislature.
And that's certainly the question that the bill sponsors. Right. Senator Steve Urquhart says absolutely not. You know, he should not be interfering in a bill that really has nothing to do with his court case.
Right.
I guess Scherer's argument is that it will create animus or something.
Okay.
What is this animus argument?
So what he apparently told the lawmakers when he met with them, with the Attorney General and Mr. Scherer met with lawmakers, was don't deal with any of these bills. There are a number of bills that were proposed in the legislature that deal with defending marriage, the right of states to do these things, the non-discrimination bill. And his advice apparently was don't take up any of those right now that might, in the public debate that surrounds the bills, look like you have animus or hatred or bigotry towards same-sex couples and LGBT people in Utah. Not sure about that. I mean, the appeal that's before the Tenth Circuit Court is a record appeal, basically. You're taking the lower court record, you're supplementing your arguments somewhat, but you have to stick to the arguments already raised there. So, you know, there's some criticism that that's an invalid argument as far as the non-discrimination bill goes.
The bill, Senate Bill 100, has been tabled by Senate leadership, and Paul Raleigh is Gene Scherer's sticking his nose where it doesn't belong, or does he have a legitimate concern there, and should lawmakers sort of heed his legal advice?
Well, what makes it suspicious about his argument on the non-discrimination bill is his agreement with the Sutherland Institute. The Sutherland Institute has a long history of opposing any kind of you know, legislation or anything else that tries to protect or gives rights to the gay and lesbian community. The Sutherland Institute a few years ago came up with this big paper, policy paper or treatise on the traditional family and you know, that a family is just, you know, just a husband and wife, you know, of the different genders. And CNAB actually passed a resolution adopting that as CNAB's position. And that led to such a backlash that writers in a lot of magazines, a lot of tourist magazines and outdoor magazines said, don't go to CNAB, you know, boycott CNAB. And people did. And then the business, the hotels and motels and operators in CNAB got upset at their city council people for adopting this resolution and bringing this controversy.
So clearly, they have influence. They do.
But that's the point. Is if you look at the history of Sutherland Institute, and they are such an advocate for one side, one position on the whole gay and lesbian issue, and then Mr. Scherer, who's supposed to be representing the state on the legal, the narrow legal issues that were brought up, have been brought up through the Shelby decision. He is now sticking his nose in all these other issues surrounding that the gay and lesbian community and their issues.
To be fair, though, Brooke, I mean, he hasn't actually received a paycheck. He's not on the payroll of Sutherland Institute yet.
That's what Paul Merrill said publicly, that he hasn't received a dime from us yet. And, I'm not sure how we'll be able to tell what he's paid by them, because they're a private nonprofit, and you know, it'll be interesting to see. He's being paid $200,000 from the state to take this appeal through the Tenth Circuit Court. Many people argue that's a low sum. I think the way the Attorney General Sean Reyes put it is, we have these all-star players at rookie contracts, is how he described it. So I think this was an effort to supplement and incentivize him to come here to do this, but it's going to take some careful watching to see how those blend over.
We need to head to a break, but before we do, the case is on its way to the Tenth Circuit.
That's right.
Give us the status, and you said there's some interesting amicus briefs that have been filed.
Right. So the state this week filed their opening brief, 120 pages. They filed it at 11:30, 30 minutes before their deadline. They laid out a rigorous defense based on saying that it's all about children and what's best for children. So what we're seeing now, well, let me just say the plaintiffs have their brief due, their response brief due, I think it's February 25th, and then the state will get one more go at it with a brief due March 4th. Right now, there are about a half a dozen amicus or friend of the court briefs that have been filed or in the process of being filed, and it's rather interesting to see who those are coming from. Lynn Wardle, for example, BYU law professor who's been a very strong advocate on traditional marriage and the natural family, is filing a brief on behalf of, quote, Utah counties. I don't know who they are yet. I sent him an email asking which Utah counties, and he did not respond. But when he files his brief, I guess we'll see. There's a amicus brief filed by the Family Research Council, private individuals, a coalition of African-American pastors. And one thing interesting is these are basically the same players who filed amicus briefs in the Ninth Circuit case in Nevada. I think in California, many of these same entities filed briefs. So this also tells you that this is an issue that needs to be taken up by the Supreme Court. You got the same arguments building up around in all these circuit courts around the country. So.
And you're on top of it. Brooke Adams, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, also with us, columnist Paul Raleigh, and county government reporter Mike Gorrell. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We need to take another quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brooke Adams, Mike Gorrell, and columnist Paul Raleigh. Mike, very quickly, something happened this week at Skyline High School, a public open house for something called the Mountain Accord. And I guess a lot of people showed up. What exactly is the Mountain Accord?
The Mountain Accord is an attempt by a lot of different organizations around town to develop an environmental impact statement that will look at how transportation, recreation, environmental issues, and the economy should be handled within an area that, branching out from Salt Lake City International Airport, that encompasses all the terrain out to Park City and through the Cottonwood Canyons.
Don't we already have a plan?
No.
It feels like we've been talking about this for a long time.
Oh, we have been talking about it for a long time, and we're going to be talking about it for a lot longer. But because there's big issues involved, like how are we going to move people up and down the canyons? Are we going to put rails in there? Are we going to do buses? Are there going to be tunnels that go over to Park City? Are there going to be gondolas that handle that? What about
the whole ski link thing?
Yeah, the interconnect between all the different ski resorts. Should you do that or should you not? How do you protect backcountry skiers' terrain? How do you respect private property rights, particularly like in Big Cottonwood Canyon, where you have quite a few people who live there?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a complex issue, but the Mountain Accord is hoping in the next year to come up with a preferred alternative that would then go to a federal agency, maybe the Highway Administration or the Transit Administration or the Forest Service, to look at these complex issues.
That's a story we're going to hear a lot more about, I assume.
Yep.
We've only got a few minutes left, but I want to get to the underplayed story of the week, a story that you think is going to gain some traction or we're going to hear a lot more of. And I guess, Brooke, I'll start with you.
Oh, boy, I want to go back in time. I want to talk about the story we had this week about the $1,200 a bottle whiskey.
Yeah. Yes, Pappy Van Winkle.
I want to know, how is it, all you people who got a bottle of that for $130? I guess it's sold at auction for up to $1,200.
Yeah.
And people are raving. There was a big line out in front of a liquor store. I don't think I've ever seen that. And I just want to know, how is it? Let us know.
Okay. Send your comments to is it Brooke?
Yeah, Brooke at sltrib.com.
Brooke at sltrib.com. Okay. Mike, your pick for this underplayed story of the week.
I think there's some really interesting local government issues that are evolving right now involving numerous things. The proposed annexation of the Olympus Hills neighborhood into Holiday. Mayor McAdams is about to introduce a bill that would freeze the boundaries of the unincorporated area and protect it all from future annexations and incorporations.
Wow, that's really underplayed. We got to hear more about that.
And it's developing, but it changes a lot. And there are still people, and a lot of this revolves around the Mill Creek community because there's the Olympus Hills community neighborhood would come out of there, but there's still a lot of support within that community to incorporate it.
Okay, Mike, we're going to count on you to tell us more about those annexation proposals. Paul, what you got?
Well, we had a story in the Salt Lake Tribune this morning that I think is a bigger story than people realize or should be, and we'll see how it plays out. But it's a bill that was passed through committee sponsored by a Democrat, Marie Paulson. It would make it a felony to distribute images, basically pornographic images or images of people unclothed or partially clothed against their will without their permission. And this issue, I think, is very serious, and it's a lot bigger than a lot of people realize. And we'll see how this bill plays out. I know the people who are sponsoring it and are in favor of it are a little worried about some people in the legislature coming up with, individual liberty arguments and things like that. But and I think that this ought to be coupled with legislation that Steve Eason, a Republican from Sandy, has been pushing for the last couple of years to try and deal with the teen suicide problem. And you know, this is all about bullying. And there is a definite link to this type of bullying, any type of bullying, and the almost epidemic problem of suicides, particularly among teens, that we have. And so I think that this is a very important issue, and we're just starting to cover it now as it moves through the legislature. But I think it's a much bigger issue than people realize at the moment.
If you haven't checked out, seen that story, check out our coverage at sltrib.com. And I believe the story has something to do with revenge porn, is what it's called. My pick for the underplayed story of the week, also a piece that appeared today, but we've heard a little bit about it a few months ago, the water supply. Utah Water Supply Report came out, snowpack at 75% of normal. The reservoirs are at 48%. We're going to have to go out and do a snow dance today.
I think this is going to be really a scary issue.
I do too. Drought conditions, we're going to be talking about that throughout the spring and the summer. So that's my pick for the underplayed story of the week. I guess I could go for the Mormon church prophet being summoned to the British court. But we'll leave that for another time. We're going to have to leave it there. Brooke Adams, Mike Gorell, Paul Raleigh, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, guys, very much for the time.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to wrap up this hour with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, a man who has profound respect for nurses.
I smashed myself up pretty good jumping out of airplanes and spent some time in the hospital getting put back together. And you can develop an emotional attachment to somebody who's your caregiver. And so I always appreciated nurses more.
This is a column that you wrote back in 2002 about the gratitude that you have for nurses. Maybe you can read a little bit.
Yeah, I'll start out with the way it began. I have this occurring nurse vision. I am sick or hurt. The door of my hospital room opens and a nurse slips inside. She is blonde, wearing a little white hat with a red cross on it and garters. Okay, wait, that's the wrong nurse vision. The real vision is where a large nurse wearing a smock so ugly that they don't even sell it at Kmart barges in and stabs me in the hams with 800 cc's of feel good.
That's so great. Yes, we all know that nurses provide a helping hand. And they, as you say in the column, they're really the backbone of the medical profession.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it wouldn't get done without them. Doctors have the knowledge and the surgical skills, but it's somebody else who's making sure it comes together at the end.
Do you think nurses get the appreciation they deserve?
No, I don't. I have a son-in-law who's a nurse and friends who are nurses, and I don't think they really get – everybody, you know, talks about doctors, but nobody ever talks about nurses. And I tend to lean toward the blue-collar side of every profession. I like cops better than lawyers, like nurses better than doctors and that sort of thing, plumbers better than architects, just because they're functional and they actually help out.
So what would elevate the stature of nurses?
Well, it can't be just any nurse. You really need a mean nurse, somebody who actually makes you get better. Because when you're hurt, you don't really feel like doing what you need to do. They're the ones who come in. I wrote this in the same column. I said, forget doctors. Nurses are the backbone of the medical profession. When I get hurt or sick, I only want two things, drugs and the truth. Nurses have both of these. I know what I'm talking about. I've been operated on 7 times. Whenever I pushed the button for pain medication, the doctor was never the one who showed up. Frankly, I would be worried if it was. Doctors always lie. Not because they are evil, although some are, but because they don't always know better.
And you got nice response.
Oh, yeah.
People really like the
call. I think I heard from every nurse in the state at that particular time, and I've been invited to speak at nursing conventions a couple of times. Yeah, maybe it's just me. I just relate to them better.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And of course, you can read his humor columns at sltrib.com. You can also hear him unplugged each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. See you next time.